Good morning and welcome to today's edition of Times the Brief, brought to you by Spoken Layer. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Times the Brief is supported by Squarespace, providing tools for creative individuals and business owners to make a website. Squarespace includes hosting, e-commerce, and 24/7 customer care. Learn more at squarespace.com/thebrief.
Presidential super PACs operating expansive shadow campaigns, buying ads, hosting town hall meetings, and hiring canvassers have raised more than twice as much money as the candidates themselves, newly filed campaign finance documents show. About three dozen such super PACs collectively raised more than $266 million from January through June, while the campaigns of 2016 presidential hopefuls collectively raised just half that much, about $130 million, according to a Center for Public Integrity review. The total raised by super PACs is about 17 times more than comparable groups raised during the same period 4 years ago, when the term super PAC had yet to make it into the dictionary. Super PACs made possible, thanks to the 2010 U.S. Supreme Court's Citizens United v. Federal Election Commission decision, can accept unlimited donations from corporations, unions, and individuals. They may use the funds to support or oppose candidates, but are prohibited from coordinating their spending with campaigns. Leading in the money chase, Right to Rise USA, a group that supports former Florida Republican Governor Jeb Bush, which raised more than $103 million. Bush helped raise millions for the group, despite the anti-coordination rules. Bush attended numerous fundraising events for the super PAC, but got around the prohibition by making appearances prior to announcing his 2016 candidacy. Two dozen donors each gave Right to Rise USA at least $1 million during the year's first half, with about 90% of it coming before Bush officially launched his campaign in June. One of those $1 million donors was Next Era Energy, a Florida-based Fortune 200 energy company. A pair of famous Texas retirees also made handsome donations to Right to Rise USA, former Presidents George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, who gave $125,000 and $95,000, respectively. While the pro-Bush super PAC dominated all others, a cluster of five super PACs supporting the presidential candidacy of Senator Ted Cruz, Republican Texas, raised about $38 million. Two groups backing Republican Governor Scott Walker of Wisconsin raised more than $26 million. And a super PAC backing Senator Marco Rubio, Republican Florida, raised about $16 million. In each case, the super PACs raised more than the candidates themselves, sometimes many times over. Bush's official campaign, for instance, has collected just $11 million to date. Never before have super PACs played such a prominent role in a presidential contest, especially so early in the process. Now, nearly every major candidate has a super PAC doppelganger. Among the Republican contenders, only celebrity business tycoon Donald Trump, who so far has self-funded the bulk of his campaign, doesn't yet have an allied super PAC capable of raising significant cash. This represents a dramatic shift from 4 years ago. At this stage of the 2012 presidential election, only President Barack Obama and eventual Republican nominee Mitt Romney enjoyed the support of aligned super PACs. Super PACs supporting many 2012 GOP hopefuls did not form until the fall or winter of 2011. The first thing I'm going to do as a presidential candidate is see if there's a super PAC out there to support me or someone willing to form a super PAC to help me, said John Grimaldi, a political operative who worked for a pro-Newt Gingrich super PAC in 2012 but is not working for a campaign or super PAC this election cycle. A super PAC eliminates a major portion of your campaign expenditures as a candidate, Grimaldi continued. It makes it easier to run. Why? The answer, in part, is that deep-pocketed donors who are prohibited from donating large sums of money directly to the candidates themselves may give unlimited amounts to super PACs, as may corporations and labor unions. candidates may only accept donations of $2,700 per person per election and $5,000 per election from corporate or labor political action committees. We are not subject to contribution limits like the campaigns are, so that certainly helps build resources to get our message out, said Jordan Russell, spokesman for the Opportunity and Freedom PAC, which is backing former Texas Governor Rick Perry's White House run. The Opportunity and Freedom PAC has already spent more than $2.3 million on advertisements touting Perry, more than twice as much as the Republicans' presidential campaign raised through the end of June. This dynamic frustrates many of the presidential contenders, and some, including Cruz, are openly calling for contribution limits to candidates to be eliminated entirely. "Our current campaign finance system is ridiculous," Cruz told the Center for Public Integrity in a recent interview. "The way to do it is to let campaigns speak for themselves directly." Even grassroots favorites, such as Republican Ben Carson, a former neurosurgeon, have allied super PACs. One super PAC working on Carson's behalf raised $13.5 million last year and another $2.9 million during the first half of 2015, while Carson's campaign, which was launched in May, has raised $10.6 million. "I personally have not gone around chasing after billionaires and special interest groups," Carson told the Center for Public Integrity. "We're getting an enormous response from the grassroots. That's the people that I want to be beholden to." Wealthy donors have certainly helped fuel the super PAC spree, and many of them are hedging their bets and supporting multiple White House contenders in a field that's grown to 17 Republicans and 5 Democrats. Rich donors, flirting with multiple Republican candidates, spread, in some cases, millions of dollars among super PACs backing different candidates. This continues a trend that first emerged after presidential candidates themselves released campaign disclosures earlier this month. Take hedge fund billionaire Robert Mercer, who laid down $11 million to a pro-Cruz super PAC called Keep the Promise One, making him practically the sole funder. That's a pretty big investment. But surprisingly, Keep the Promise One steered $500,000 to a super PAC backing Cruz rival Carly Fiorina, presumably at Mercer's direction, and possibly a sign that were Cruz to falter or withdraw, Mercer could direct the super PAC elsewhere. On top of that, Mercer wrote a $250,000 check to Believe Again, a super PAC supporting Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal's Republican presidential bid. Then there's former Univision CEO Jerry Perenchio, who was the biggest donor to the super PAC backing Fiorina, who gave nearly $1.6 million. He also gave $100,000 to the pro-Bush Right to Rise USA super PAC. Meanwhile, Robert McNair, the billionaire owner of the NFL's Houston Texans, donated $500,000 apiece to super PACs backing Republicans Bush, Cruz, Walker, and Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. An investment firm tied to Manoj Bhargava, the politically active founder of beverage company 5-Hour Energy, similarly placed multiple six-figure bets on super PACs supporting 3 GOP presidential candidates, all governors. The company, called ETC Capital LLC, gave $150,000 to America Leads, a super PAC backing New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, $150,000 to the Untimidated PAC, which supports Walker, and $100,000 to the pro-Jindal Believe Again super PAC. Bhargava's investment firm was among the top 5 donors last year to the Republican Governors Association, so it's perhaps not surprising that the firm would back 3 current Republican governors seeking the White House, 2 of whom, Christie and Jindal, are past RGA chairs. Even Marlene Ricketts, the matriarch of the family that owns the Chicago Cubs baseball team, and the mother of Walker's campaign finance chairman, Todd Ricketts, spread her money around. She donated $10,000 each to groups backing Bush, Christie, Cruz, Graham, Perry, and Rubio. But her largest donation, $4.9 million, went to Walker's Unintimidated PAC, representing a quarter of the super PAC's take. Bradley Crate, chief financial officer for Mitt Romney's 2012 presidential campaign, said that 4 years ago, Super PAC leaders proceeded with a measure of caution, afraid of violating laws that restricted how they interfaced with political candidates. Today, such fears have largely dissipated, with the ideologically gridlocked Federal Election Commission often unable to agree on how to interpret and regulate the most basic of election law matters. This gives super PACs the opportunity to work more intimately with candidates. Some are even absorbing many of the responsibilities traditionally reserved for a candidate's own campaign, said Crate, now president of Red Curve Solutions, a Massachusetts-based campaign finance consulting firm. That's what I would do, he said. This article posted by the Center for Public Integrity, Michael Beckel, Dave Leventhal, Carrie Levine, and Ben Weeder. Baltimore reached a grim milestone on Friday, 3 months after riots erupted in response to the death of Freddie Gray in police custody. With 45 homicides in July, the city has seen more bloodshed in a single month than it has in 43 years. Police reported 3 deaths, 2 men shot Thursday and 1 on Friday. The men died at local hospitals. With their deaths, this year's homicides reached 189, far outpacing the 119 killings by July's end in 2014. Non-fatal shootings have soared to 366, compared to 200 by the same date last year. July's total was the worst since the city recorded 45 killings in August 1972, according to the Baltimore Sun. The seemingly Sisyphean task of containing the city's violence prompted Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake to fire her police commissioner, Anthony Batts, on July 8th. "Too many continue to die on our streets," Rawlings Blake said then. "Families are tired of dealing with this pain, and so am I. Recent events have placed an intense focus on our police leadership, distracting many from what needs to be our main focus, the fight against crime." But the killings have not abated under Interim Commissioner Kevin Davis since then. Baltimore is not unique in its suffering. Crimes are spiking in big cities around the country. But while the city's police are closing cases, Davis announced arrests in 3 recent murders several days ago, the violence is outpacing their efforts. Davis said Tuesday the clearance rate is at 36.6%, far lower than the department's mid-40s average. Crime experts and residents of Baltimore's most dangerous neighborhoods cite a confluence of factors: mistrust of the police, generalized anger and hopelessness over a lack of opportunities for young black men, and competition among dealers of illegal drugs, bolstered by the looting of prescription pills from pharmacies during the riot. Federal drug enforcement agents said gangs targeted 32 pharmacies in the city, taking roughly 300,000 doses of opiates, as the riots caused $9 million in property damage in the city. Perched on a friend's stoop, Sherry Moore, 55, said she knew mostly all of the young men killed recently in West Baltimore, including an 18-year-old fatally shot a half block away. Moore said many more pills are on the street since the riot, making people wilder than usual. "The ones doing the violence, the shootings, they're eating Percocet like candy, and they're not thinking about consequences. They have no discipline. They have no respect. They think this is a game. How many can I put down on the east side? How many can I put down on the west side?" The tally of 42 homicides in May included Gray, who died in April after his neck was broken in police custody. The July tally likewise includes a previous death, a baby whose death in June was ruled a homicide in July. Sean Ellerman, assistant special agent in charge of the Baltimore Division of the Drug Enforcement Administration, said May's homicide spike was probably related to the stolen prescription drugs, a supply that is likely exhausted by now. But the drug trade is inherently violent, and turf wars tend to prompt retaliatory killings. "You can't attribute every murder to narcotics, but I would think a good number of them are," he said. "You could say it's retaliation from drug trafficking. It's retaliation from gangs moving in from other territories. But there have been drug markets in Baltimore for years." Across West Baltimore, residents complain that drug addiction and crime are part of a cycle that begins with despair among children who lack educational and recreational opportunities and extends when people can't find work. "We need jobs. We need jobs," a man riding around on a bicycle shouted to anyone who'd listen after four people were shot, three of them fatally, on a street corner in July. More community engagement, progressive policing policies, and opportunities for young people in poverty could help, community activist Munir Bahar said. "People are focusing on enforcement, not preventing violence. Police enforce a code, a law. Our job as the community is to prevent the violence, and we have failed," said Bahar, who leads the annual 300-men march against violence in West Baltimore. "We need anti-violence organizations. We need mentorship programs. We need a long-term solution. But we also need immediate relief," Bahar added. "When we're in something so deep, we have to stop it before you can analyze what the root is." Strained relationships between police and the public also play a role, according to Eugene O'Donnell, a professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Arrests plummeted and violence soared after six officers were indicted in Gray's death. Residents accused police of abandoning their posts for fear of facing criminal charges for making arrests, and said emboldened criminals were settling scores with little risk of being caught. The department denied these claims, and police cars have been evident patrolling West Baltimore's central thoroughfares recently. But O'Donnell said the perception of lawlessness is just as powerful than the reality. "We have a national issue where the police feel they are the public enemy number one," he said, making some officers stand down and criminals become more brazen. "There's a rhythm to the streets," he added, "and when people get away with gun violence, it has a long-term emboldening effect. And the good people in the neighborhood think, who has the upper hand?" This article posted by Juliet Linderman of the Associated Press.
Uber recently closed a new funding round that values the car-hailing startup close to $51 billion, the Wall Street Journal reported Friday. That's the highest valuation ever for a venture-backed company, topping the $50 billion Facebook was valued at in 2011 when it completed its last round of fundraising before going public. Uber also crossed the $50 billion mark in 5 years, a feat Facebook took 7 years to accomplish. Uber's new valuation is also $5 billion more than Chinese smartphone maker Xiaomi, which at $46 billion is believed to be the second highest valued venture-backed private company. Uber raised close to $1 billion in the new deal, which was reported to be in the works earlier this year. At the time, Fortune said Uber might have trouble living up to the hype. Since then, the company has hit some bumps, including a face-off with New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. A leaked financial report suggested Uber's fast growth was coming along with big losses. A prospectus for a convertible bond offering reported by Bloomberg said that Uber had lost $470 million on $415 million in revenue. An Uber spokesperson said that number was out of date. Despite the enormous valuation for the five-year-old Uber, the fresh fundraising round might suggest investors are growing nervous about the company and its high expectations. Earlier this year, it was reported that Uber was looking to raise between $1.5 billion and $2 billion. Instead, Uber pulled in just half of the high end of that range. And given how much money the company may be losing, hailing more investors at a valuation that might make the company worth significantly more than Facebook could become increasingly difficult. This article posted by Stephen Gandell for Fortune. The professional wrestling legend known as Rowdy Roddy Piper has died at his Hollywood, California home, officials and World Wrestling Entertainment said. He was 61. Piper's agent Jay Schachter said in a statement that Rod passed peacefully in his sleep last night. "I am shocked and beyond devastated," Schachter said. "He was an icon, a legend, an amazing man, and a true friend." In 2006, the WWE announced that Piper had been diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma and would receive treatment. Piper, whose real name is Roderick George Toombs, joined World Wrestling Entertainment in 1984. Before that, he wrestled in the NWA. Piper was known for his on-air feud with Hulk Hogan, and the Wrestling Entertainment Company said Piper began his career as one of the most hated villains ever to step between the ropes. Piper and Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff took on Hogan and Mr. T in the first ever WrestleMania. WWE calls the bout one of the marquee main events in its history. Piper was inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame in 2005. He was also named one of the WWE's top 50 villains. Roddy Piper was one of the most entertaining, controversial, and bombastic performers ever in WWE, beloved by millions of fans around the world, WWE Chairman and CEO Vince McMahon said in a statement. I extend my deepest condolences to his family. Piper starred in the 1988 John Carpenter cult classic sci-fi film They Live. Carpenter said Thursday he was devastated by the news. He was a great wrestler, a masterful entertainer, and a good friend, Carpenter said in a post on Facebook. Piper is survived by his wife, Kitty, and their four children. Other wrestlers shared their condolences and fond memories on Twitter Thursday. Zack Ryder tweeted, R.I.P., Rowdy Roddy Piper. I'll never forget you smashing a coconut over my head at WrestleMania 27. The Iron Sheik tweeted, Roddy Piper, I love you forever. God bless you, Bubba. And from John Layfield, just heard my friend and a huge influence on me, Hot Rod Roddy Piper, has passed away. Rest well, my friend. You will be missed. Hashtag life well lived. This article posted by Andrew Blankstein and Phil Helsel. U.S. lawmakers joined the chorus of outrage over the killing of Cecil the Lion on Friday, announcing a bill that would stop people from importing trophies gleaned from hunting potentially endangered animals. The bill, partly an acronym for Cecil's name, Conserving Ecosystems by Ceasing the Importation of Large Animal Trophies Act, would make it illegal for trophy hunters to bring back parts of any species proposed or listed as threatened or endangered under the Endangered Species Act of 1973. Let's not be cowardly lions when it comes to trophy killing, Senator Bob Menendez said in a public statement, adding that the legislation is a necessary and prudent step that creates a disincentive for these senseless trophy killings and advances our commitment in leading the fight to combat global wildlife trafficking. The bill is co-sponsored by Senators Cory Booker, Richard Blumenthal, and Ben Cardin. The proposed legislation comes after an outpouring of rage against a Minnesota dentist who paid $55,000 to slay the lion during a hunting excursion in Zimbabwe. African lions are not considered endangered species, but last year the United States Fish and Wildlife Service proposed placing them on a list of threatened animals. This article posted by Dan Kedmi.
The U.S. Marine Corps declared a new squadron of F-35 fighter jets ready for deployment on Friday, yielding the first shipment from a controversial $400 billion fighter program that has struggled through years of costly delays. A squadron of 10 F-35B Lightning II aircraft passed a final round of inspections on July 18th, according to a statement by the U.S. Marine Corps. The F-35B's ability to conduct operations from expeditionary airstrips or sea-based carriers provides our nation with its first fifth-generation strike fighter, which will transform the way we fight and win, Marine Corps General Joseph Dunford said in a public statement. More than 50 pilots and 500 maintenance crew members have been trained on the newest variant of F-35 fighter jet. This story posted by Dan Kebney.
Times the Brief is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace is the easiest way to create a beautiful website, blog, or online store for you and your ideas. Squarespace features an elegant interface, beautiful templates, and incredible 24/7 customer support. Try Squarespace at squarespace.com and enter offer code THEBRIEF at checkout to get 10% off. Squarespace. Build it beautiful.
Glenn Martin knows exactly the kind of difference getting an education can make for a person behind bars. When Martin was 23, he was sentenced to 6 years in prison for robbery. That time, he told Time on Friday, was arguably the lowest point in his life. But a meeting he had with a corrections officer during his early days behind bars in state prison in New York changed his life. After reviewing his file, the officer suggested that he consider advancing his education and enrolling in college courses. "That was the first time anyone had ever said to me, 'You should go to college,'" Martin says. "I grew up in the Bedford-Stuyvesant neighborhood of Brooklyn. I distinctly remember people saying the opposite to me." While in prison, Martin was able to earn his associate's degree through a prison education program called the Consortium of the Niagara Frontier, one of New York's oldest post-secondary correctional education programs. It was in that program that Martin says he was able to consider all of the possibilities that lie ahead of him in life. "I started to think of myself differently," Martin says. "I saw hope beyond being in that prison for 6 years." Now at 43, Martin serves as the president of Just Leadership USA, an organization aimed at significantly reducing the incarceration rate nationwide by 2030. And it was in that role that Martin was invited to attend an event at a prison in Maryland on Friday, where he participated in a roundtable discussion with the U.S. Attorney General and the Secretary of Education. As Time reported earlier this week, Attorney General Loretta Lynch and Secretary of Education Arne Duncan traveled to the Maryland Correctional Institution at Jessup to announce that the administration would temporarily grant incarcerated individuals access to federal aid that can help them pay for college. The experimental initiative reverses a 1994 law that blocked state and federal prisoners' access to Pell Grants, which critics say hurt their chances to start over. The research on the topic of institutional education is clear. According to a 2013 study by the RAND Corporation, funded by the U.S. Department of Justice, prisoners who took educational courses behind bars were 43% less likely to return to prison in 3 years than those who did not. With about 1.5 million Americans behind bars, changing the Pell Grant system could have a major effect. America is a nation of second chances, giving people who have made mistakes in their lives a chance to get back on track and become contributing members of society is fundamental to who we are, Duncan said in a statement. Through the pilot program, prisoners who are eligible for release within the next 5 years and otherwise meet the requirements for federal aid could have access to grants to pay for tuition, fees, books, and supplies. Though the program is limited to Pell Grants and does not apply to any other type of aid, those who work in education are hopeful. Vivian Nixon, the executive director of the College and Community Fellowship, an organization that helps formerly incarcerated women get an education, didn't have a chance to get an education while she was behind bars. When she was in her mid-30s, Nixon was sentenced to 3.5 years in prison for a series of white-collar crimes. The possibility of being able to further her education while incarcerated gave Nixon hope, but those dreams were dashed when she was transferred to a prison that didn't offer any post-secondary education courses. After suffering bouts of hopelessness and depression, Nixon started tutoring other women working toward their GED behind bars. Over the past decade and a half, she's made it her mission to get the federal government to make it easier for prisoners to get an education. "Education is transformative," Nixon says. "When people are educated, it opens up a whole set of different choices, and without the kind of knowledge or confidence that education brings, you can easily slip back into the old habits that landed you in prison." For Nixon and Martin, who collaborated to form the Education from the Inside Out Coalition, an organization that aims to increase educational opportunities for prisoners, Friday was a special day. Both of them saw their handiwork come to fruition firsthand. "For decades, we've dealt with this issue in ways that make for good politics, but bad policy," Martin said. "This is an opportunity to undo some of that." This article posted by Maya Rodan.
Miami. The Coast Guard says it's suspending its search at sunset for two teenage fishermen who've been missing for a week. Captain Mark Fedor says the search continues in the meantime and has been a true all-hands-on-deck effort. The 14-year-old boys, Perry Cohen and Austin Stefanos, went missing last Friday, and their capsized boat was found Sunday. The Coast Guard has searched waters from South Florida up through South Carolina without success. The boys' families say they plan to continue a private search even after the Coast Guard's efforts end. The boys are described as consummate seamen who grew up on the water and spent much of their free time boating and fishing. A Florida congressman who represents the community where the two teenage fishermen went missing at sea is urging the U.S. Coast Guard to keep searching Friday. Representative Patrick E. Murphy issued a statement with a simple plea, keep looking. 14-year-olds Perry Cohen and Austin Stefanos of Tequesta have been missing since they set out on a fishing trip a week ago. Their capsized boat was found Sunday. The Coast Guard has said it will keep searching until it believes there's no reasonable chance the boys could still be found alive. The agency has scheduled a noon news conference on the search. Murphy, a Democrat, noted that the water temperatures are warm and the two teens know the water well. This article posted by Matt Sadensky of the Associated Press.
Skydiving is tricky enough on its own, but trying to form a shape with 163 other people nearly 20,000 feet in the sky is even tougher. The daunting nature of the task didn't dissuade the group of skilled skydivers who jumped out of 7 different airplanes at precise moments in an effort to set a new world record for a vertical skydiving formation. The group succeeded, creating a formation that resembled a giant flower over central Illinois on Friday, while hurtling headfirst toward the ground at speeds of up to 240 miles per hour. It took the team, which was selected from training camps in the U.S., Spain, and Australia, 13 attempts to get it right, but they ultimately broke the record of 138 divers set in 2012. "It's awesome, man," said Rock Nelson, one of the organizers. "It just goes to show that if you can get the right group of people together and the right support team and good conditions, anything is possible, even on attempt number 13. The team was also accompanied by 4 skydiving videographers who chronicled the journey to the ground. This article posted by Eric Dodds.
On the heels of a major suicide bombing in the border town of Sirte a couple of weeks ago, Turkey has officially joined the war against ISIS, though it's not clear what it actually aims to achieve. Turkey and its leader, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, were riding high just a few years ago, with a strong economy and a growing international profile. Now the country's economy is tumbling and its politics are fragmenting. These 5 facts explain Turkey's various motivations for going to war. Be warned, they're complicated. 1. A faltering economy. Until recently, Turkey was an emerging market darling. In 2010, its economy was growing at a robust 9.2%. But by 2013, GDP growth had fallen to 4.1%. The slowdown has continued, and growth for 2015 is now forecast at 3.1%, which may actually be a generous estimate. Unemployment in the country has reached 11%, the highest rate in 5 years. It's not clear that joining the fight against ISIS will directly help Turkey's economy. In fact, it probably won't. Fighting wars, especially open-ended ones, costs money. But it will distract a populace that's growing increasingly unsettled by the economy slowdown. 2. Stumbling AKP. The slowing economy has also upended the country's politics. Turkey was a secular Muslim country for nearly a century until 2002, when Erdogan's Islamic Justice and Development Party, the AKP, rose to power. It went on to win 4 consecutive elections, peaking at 49.9% in 2011, while presiding over a booming economy. Since then, Erdogan has seen his personal popularity plunge from 71% to 37.5% today. Support for the AKP dropped nearly 10% in elections this past June, and the party lost an absolute legislative majority it had enjoyed for 13 years. Who capitalized on the AKP's poor election performance? The pro-Kurdish HDP, which entered parliament for the first time by capturing 13% of the vote. Political parties must win at least 10% of the vote in Turkey in order to enter the legislature. Now the AKP must choose between inviting an opposition party to join a coalition government or calling early elections to try to regain its majority. Joining the ISIS war effort serves 2 political aims. It tarnishes the HDP by associating the party with Kurdish separatist groups accused of terrorism, and it drums up enough nationalist sentiment to peel off votes from the far-right Nationalist Movement Party. Erdogan will watch the polls. If the AKP's numbers rise toward 50%, he's likely to push for another vote. 3. Syrian refugees in Turkey. Turkey is currently providing shelter for nearly 2 million Syrian refugees, and that figure is projected to rise another 500,000 by the end of 2015. Put another way, more than half of the 4 million Syrians who have fled their country during the civil war now reside in Turkey. Ankara has established 25 refugee camps, and reports say they are relatively well run. The problem is the cost. Ankara estimates that it has spent nearly $5.6 billion on refugees since the beginning of the crisis. Combined with its flagging economy, it is not clear how much longer Turkey can continue shouldering the burden. The sooner the fighting in Syria ends, the sooner these refugees can return home. 4. Violent history with the PKK. Now things start to get murky. On July 20th, an ISIS suicide bomb ripped through the Turkish town of Surak, killing 32 people. The victims were supporters of the Kurdistan Workers' Party, the PKK, the Kurdish Separatist Party based in Turkey and affiliated with the People's Protection Units, the YPG, the Kurdish group currently battling ISIS in Syria. After the Surak attack, some Turks blamed the AKP government for not protecting the country against terrorism, while Turkish Kurds have accused the government of being complicit in the attacks. They claim that Erdogan's government has tolerated ISIS attacks on Kurds because ISIS militants threaten Syria's Bashar al-Assad, Turkey's enemy, and also prevent Kurds from gaining ground in Syria that might help them to eventually create a larger Kurdish homeland in the region. Erdogan may have declared war on ISIS to blunt criticism that he is soft on terrorism, but this bombing really speaks to the long-strained relationship between Turks and Kurds. The Kurds are a sizable ethnic minority in the region that have been agitating for independence for decades. The last 40 years have been marred by Turkish-Kurdish violence, claiming the lives of 40,000 people. A ceasefire was reached in March 2013, but it didn't last long. According to Turkish security authorities, the PKK has carried out over 2,000 acts of violence in 2015 alone. 5. A war against whom? It's obvious that Ankara is alarmed by the progress Kurdish fighters in Syria are making against ISIS and Assad, which they fear will only stoke the independence dreams of Turkish Kurds. In response to the Surak bombing, Turkish police launched security raids across the country, rounding up more than 1,300 suspects in a matter of days. But the number of PKK militants detained outnumber ISIS affiliates more than 6-1. Between July 23rd and July 26th, 75 Turkish jets flew 155 sorties against 400 or so PKK targets. Number of ISIS targets hit? 3. Officially joining the war against ISIS will give Turkey the cover it needs to bomb the Kurdish separatists carving out territories along the Turkish border. And it seems Washington is willing to ignore attacks on Kurds in exchange for U.S. access to the airbase useful for bombing ISIS inside Iraq. Only time will tell if Turkey and America's political and military strategies will pay off. This article posted by Ian Bremmer. Two University of Cincinnati police officers who were at the scene just after a fellow officer fatally shot a driver are not being charged, a prosecutor said Friday. The Hamilton County grand jury did not return indictments against Philip Kidd and David Lindenschmidt. The announcement that they wouldn't be charged came a day after former officer Ray Tenzing pleaded not guilty to murder and voluntary manslaughter in the July 19th shooting of Samuel DeBose. Kidd and Lindenschmidt were put on administrative leave this week during a university investigation. The officers haven't responded to messages left at the school's police department and at a possible home number for Lindenschmidt. No home number could be found for Kidd. A police report and body camera video from the two officers show they were on the scene just after the shooting. Footage showed Tenzing getting up from the ground after DeBose had been shot. Tenzing's attorney has said Tenzing fired at DeBose because he thought he was going to be dragged under the motorist's car. Kidd can be heard on body camera video saying yes to another officer's question on whether he saw Tenzing dragged. Prosecutors have said Tenzing was not dragged, and Tenzing's own body video camera did not show any dragging. County Prosecutor Joe Deters said Kidd and Lindenschmidt arrived as Tenzing reached into DeBose's car. Their official statements about what happened matched what was shown on Tenzing's body camera, and neither officer said in official interviews that he saw Tenzing being dragged, according to Deters. Both officers made comments at the scene, but later were interviewed in depth by Cincinnati police about what they had witnessed, according to Deters. These officers have been truthful and honest about what happened, and no charges are warranted, Deters said. DeBose's family has asked prosecutors to investigate the other officers. The family's attorney, Mark O'Mara, said in an email Friday that they are still concerned with the initial rendition of facts given by the officers, but he said the family respects the grand jury's decision. Also Friday, the county coroner released preliminary autopsy findings showing that DeBose died of a single gunshot wound to the head. Meanwhile, Tenzing is trying to get his job back. He was fired shortly after his indictment Wednesday and released on bail Thursday. The executive director of the FOP Ohio Labor Council, a division of the Fraternal Order of Police of Ohio, said Friday that the union filed a grievance on Tenzing's behalf Wednesday to try to get him reinstated. The union said the university violated Tenzing's employment contract by not giving him a pre-disciplinary conference and a copy of the formal charges, Executive Director Catherine Brockman said. University spokeswoman Michelle Ralston said it stands by its decision to terminate Tenzing. This article posted by Lisa Cornwell for the Associated Press in Cincinnati.
Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton released 8 years of tax returns Friday, as well as a complete listing of the millions she and her husband have received for paid speeches over the years. Clinton's release of her returns from 2007 to 2014 bring to 38 the number of years of publicly released tax returns by the Clintons over the course of four presidential campaigns, topping former Florida Governor Jeb Bush's previous record of 33 years set last month. Since 2007, the Clintons have paid $43,885,310 in federal taxes, with an effective tax rate of 35.7% in 2014, roughly the same as Bush's average of 36%. The Clintons reported devoting more than 10% of their income to charity, outpacing Bush's reported 3.1% average from 2007 to 2013. Earlier this year, Clinton filed her personal financial disclosure, revealing she and her husband earned more than $30 million in paid speeches since January 2014. In a statement coinciding with the release, Clinton reiterated her call for comprehensive tax reform, including closing the carried interest loophole and passing the so-called Buffett rule, which would set a minimum effective tax rate for the highest earners. Contrasting her plan with Republicans, Clinton repeated her call to raise the short-term capital gains tax rate for those in the highest income bracket. "They want to give me another tax cut I don't need, instead of putting middle-class families first," Clinton said of Republicans. "Families like mine that reap rewards from our economy have a responsibility to pay our fair share. And it's not just the right thing to do, it's also good for growth." This article posted by Zeke J. Miller.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.